Thought we could look at the laws of Kibud Av V'Em and try to understand why they are. Why is this section? Why is this one of the Ten Commandments? As of by way of background, and then try to look a little bit in the Shulchan Aruch. Is that okay? Enthusiastic crowd. All right, so in Siman Reish Mem, you have the laws of honoring parents. So the first question is, the obvious question, I think, is why is honoring parents one of the Ten Commandments? That's the first question. I think the second question will be, why is Kibud Av V'Em, honoring parents, in the first five of Aseres HaDibros? You know, the Ten Commandments are split into five and five. And the first five are Ben Adam L'Makim, that's between us and Hashem. And the second are between us and us, right? Human beings, right? That's very clear. The first five are Anecha Hashem Elokecha, which is Emunah, relationship with Hashem, Lo Yelecha, not to have any alternative, no idolatry, Shabbos, which is a testimony to Hashem's creation, not using Hashem's name incorrectly, it's a dishonor to Hashem. Those are clearly mitzvahs between us and Hashem. The second five are clearly interpersonal. Not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not bearing false witness against someone, not coveting other people's things. Those are clearly interpersonal. So the question is really, why did Hashem include the mitzvah of honoring parents on the first half, which is really relating to Hashem? After all, human parents are human. I mean, not that every young child would always agree to that, but parents are a specific or special case of human beings. So when you relate to your parents, surely that is interpersonal. They may be unique human beings, but certainly they are in the category. They are certainly in the category of humans. So the question is, why are they listed on the first half, which is Ben Adam L'Makim? That's the second question. So let's pay a little attention to the first one. First of all, why is this one of the Ten Commandments? You know that the Rambam has as one of his principles the fact that if you take anything out of Torah, the Torah is invalid. There's nothing that's more essential. He says if you take out the pasuk va'achais loitan timna, the Torah collapses. It's invalid. So why are 10 things more important than any others? Or why are 10 listed specifically? When Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain, he was holding the luchos on which 10 commandments are written. Why are there 10? And of course, the second element of that question is, why are these the 10? If you tell me they're fundamental in some sense, I would say the ikrim are fundamental, the 13 ikrim are fundamental. That raises another question, of course. Where do the ikrim come from? How did the Rambam see fit to list 13 ikrim, which are not the same as the 10 commandments at all? That's another question. But it wouldn't seem that coveting, for example, not coveting other people's possessions, it doesn't seem that that's as important as, is that as important as not taking interest or as other aspects of the Torah where, you know, not giving your children to Melech and, there's so many, 613 mitzvahs. Why is coveting up there with the 10? So the question is really, what's the meaning of 10? Why are they singled out? Why are they more important in some way, and why these 10? And the answer is they're not more important. They are the roots of all the rest. That's the fundamental concept. These 10 are the roots. Moshe Rabbeinu was not bringing down 10 commandments. You know, the Western notion is that these are the basis. This is morality. You know, the rest is sort of optional. Now, the 10 commandments, that makes you a religious and a moral person. The rest are optional. So he came down from the mountain. He was carrying the 10 that are important. Now, the rest are somehow less important. That's not the right idea. The right idea is when he came down from the mountain carrying the luchos, he was carrying the whole Torah. He was carrying the Torah. He was carrying the genetic inner material of Torah. He was carrying the 10 categories or the 10 roots out of which all the others branch. In fact, if you know how to do it, you can show how every mitzvah in the Torah is located in one of the 10 commandments. These are the archetypes, if you like. These are the groups. And not only that, each of them, you know, you have to understand, the way the Torah works is always an organic process, right? Torah is never a list of items, each of which is a single equivalent item. Torah is always an organic listing. And this is a fundamental thing to grasp. The way Torah works is like life. Or more accurately, life is like Torah. And the way life processes work is that you start with a point that contains everything. We call that a seed or a conception. And in that seed, the rest of the process is contained. As the process unfolds, the way it works is the first point in the process contains everything. The second point develops out of the first and contains the rest of the process. The third develops out of the second and contains the rest. Right? And so it goes until you get to the very last step, which has only itself. Right? And nothing more to give. It has nothing in itself more than itself. That only applies to the very last step in the process in Torah. Of course, the mystical idea, I'm sure you're all aware, is that when you get to the last, you've actually reached back to the point of origin in many different ways. You know, I don't have to tell you that if you add the letters of the Aleph base together, you get first the units, then you get from Chaf, you get the tens, then you get the final letters, they give you the hundreds, and if you put them all together, you get 999, right? If you put all the letters of the Aleph base together, it adds up to 999. What comes after 999, which is easy if you want to remember, it's the gematria of Petach Tikva. That's 999. Very important reason for that. But anyway.
That doesn't work.
Why? You get
if
the
you
tens.
The last four letters alone, you have 1,000 already.
The final letters. The final letters. Do you have how much?
The four last letters.
You have,
you have
first of all 9 units. You have 9 units up to 10, up to 9. Then you get 90 tens, right? Yeah. Then you get 9 hundreds. Yeah. 4 and the 5 final letters. That's 500. You understand?
That way.
So you get 999 when you put the letters together, and of course when you finish 999 you get to Aleph, which is Aleph, back to the beginning, right? Why is Aleph the same as Aleph? Because you always, when you get to the end, you have revealed what was Seif Maasev Machshava Tchila. This is what the Kabbalists call the snake that has his tail in his mouth. I'm sure you're all aware of that. The world sits on 2 snakes. One is the straight one, and one is the one that has his tail in his mouth. But anyway, be that as it may. So processes in Torah are always working like that. The first point contains the whole of the process. A seed contains everything. When a child is conceived at that moment, when the genes fuse to form the child, at that instant, his color of his eyes is coded for, and the shape of his nose, and all the way his body will look is already coded for. True, it is very compressed and you can't see it, but time will reveal what was there in the first moment. The Chazal say the world was not created in 6 days. It was created in one instant. But in 6 days was a revelation of all that had been created in that first moment. And Torah always unfolds like that. For example, the Torah, you can see it like this. Torah, I would say, has 2 directions of unfolding. It has a chronological direction beginning with Bereshis, right? You start with Genesis, Bereshis, and then you move through time. And it starts with Anoichi, spiritually, and you move down into the world, right? The 2 points of origin. Two ways to look at Torah unfolding. If you look at Bereshis, you see that the whole Torah is contained in the word Bereshis, right? The whole Torah is contained in the word Bereshis, because if that is the point of origin, that, according to the Gemara, is the first of the 10 sayings of creation. Zohar says Yior was the first one. But without going into that argument right now, the Gemara says Bereshis is the first mamar, the first thing that, so to speak, was said in creation of the world. Well, if it's the first point, if it's the moment of conception, then it must contain the whole process. And therefore, there are those who will take the word Bereshis, 6 letters, and rearrange the 6 letters in every possible permutation, and each permutation of the 6 letters is another version of Bereshis. Right? The word Bereshis spells Bara Shes. He created 6. That's what he did. He created 6. But you see, it's in the first word. Is the fact that he created 6. Created 6 days. Created 6,000 years. Or you can rearrange the letters to spell Yirei Shabbos, which means the awe of moving towards Shabbos, which is the end point. Or it spells Bris Esh. Right? Bris Esh, the covenant of fire. Or it spells Yashar Aleph Beis Taf. Yashar, to go straight. Hashem created the world to go straight. From the very beginning, which is Aleph Beis, that's the most basic word in Hebrew. Can't put any more basic word together than that. The first 2 letters of the Aleph Beis, which means the Father, or the Father's desire to create. From there to the Taf, right? Whichever way you rearrange Breshis, you are getting another version of another idea, another element in the concept of the worlds being created. Obviously, it's a point of origin. It must be like that. Or the Gaon of Vilna said that every mitzvah in the Torah is contained in the word Breshis. If you know how, you could derive every mitzvah from the word Breshis. Once they were sitting at a pidgin aben, redemption of the firstborn son after 30 days, and they turned to the Gaon and they said to him, where does it say pidgin aben in the word Breshis? And the Gaon said, ben rishon achas shloshim yoim tifte. That is what the six letters of the word Breshis spell. You shall redeem the firstborn son after 30 days. So the concept is, this is not some sort of a game. It is the idea that if it's the first word, it must contain everything. No one would study the body without going back to genetics. You're not a professional if you look at the human body without going back to the genetic level, because that's where the deepest and most compressed root that is expressing itself. And the Torah begins twice. It begins Breshis to run through history, but it begins Anochi, and obviously Breshis begins with a base, because you're talking about the creation of a finite world, a differentiated particulate world. Whereas when you talk about Anochi, you're talking about Torah coming down from Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And so it begins with an Aleph. And that's why the Gemara says, the Chazal say, the whole Torah is contained in the Ten Commandments. All of the ten are contained in the first one, Anochi, Hashem Elokeinu. The first is all contained in the first word, Anochi. Right? And all of the first words contained in the Aleph, its first letter. Anochi, the Gemara says, is an acronym of Ana Nafshi Ksivas Yehivas, that I have written myself and given myself to you. That's the word Anochi, I. The word Anochi in Hebrew means I. The letters spell out, I have written myself and given myself to you. Right? I've manifested in Torah and given that to you. Right? Anochi means me, myself. You know, in Hebrew, the Ani and Anochi are two different words, so you know that. Ani means I in relationship to you, and Anochi means I in myself, what I actually am. My intrinsic existence, that's called Anochi. So the Ten Commandments are really containing the whole Torah. The first of the commandments contains all ten. The first word, I am, Hashem, obviously contains all the reality. And the Aleph, as I'm sure you're aware, contains all of that. The Aleph, as I'm sure you know, is two yuds and a vav. You know that? Aleph is two yuds and a vav. The ten middas coming down from the higher world, reflected as they reflected in this world, joined by the vav, which means the letter that connects them. Right? That is 26, of course. Two tens and a vav is 26, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei. That Aleph really tells the whole story of creation in many different ways. So the exercise is that the Ten Commandments are not more important, you know, or sufficient in themselves. It doesn't mean that. It means that all 613 can be derived from the Ten. When you're holding those and you know how to apply them, each one to run its program, as it were, And you realize, of course, the ten themselves follow such an organic process. All the ten are contained in the first one, too. What does that mean? Anecha Hashem Elokecha, obviously. Obviously, that contains all the mitzvahs. Right? Obviously, that is the ultimate mitzvah. Whenever you fulfill any mitzvah, you are also fulfilling the relationship with Hashem. The second of the commandments, you shall have no other gods, right? Lo yelecha. That really is the root of all negative commandments. The first is the root of all positive commandments, and of course the root of all commandments. The second is the root of all negative commands, right? Obviously, any time you break a negative commandment, you are declaring that there's a God other than Hashem, namely you. Right? When you do something you want to do that you're told not to do, you are breaking both the first and the second.
So the positive commandments contain the negative, and the negative doesn't contain the positive.
Of course, yes, of course. The positive commandments are always Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That means whenever you do a positive commandment, you are manifesting your relationship with Hashem. Whenever you abstain from a negative, you're also manifesting your relationship with Hashem. When you don't steal, when you feel like stealing, right? So on the one hand, you're fulfilling the negative commandment of not stealing, and you're fulfilling the positive command of relating to Hashem. You're not stealing because Hashem told you not to. So you've gone all the way back, obviously. That's why negative commandments don't actually build anything in the world. A negative command, when you walk out of here this afternoon, you walk past the local jewelry store window and you don't throw a brick through the window, which I'm sure you're sorely tempted to do, you are fulfilling the mitzvah of not stealing. Nothing happens in the world. Nothing gets built in the spiritual world. Right? All that does is protect the world from damage. Whereas when you fulfill a positive mitzvah, like you take a lulav, you build enormous structures in the higher worlds. Right? So that is where the... Anyway, so that... Therefore, the Ten Commandments, right, are themselves the root, each one folded back in the one before it. Yeah, they're an unfolding sequence. The first one is the seed of all of them. The second reveals what was in the seed at that level. The third comes out of the second. It's an organic process unfolding itself from a root, each one the cause of the one that comes after, or more accurately, each one the cause of all that come after. And the Ten Commandments are the roots of all areas in Torah. Of course, they're ten, because as you must be aware, the Torah is always structured in ten layers, right? There's always ten emanations of Hashem's Metzias in the world, and that's why there are ten commandments. What bothers you about the number 613? What should it have been?
610 or 620.
1,000. It should have been 1,000, right? Should have been 1,000 if it's an unfolding correctly of the 10. And in fact, the Ramchal makes that very clear. There are 1,000. There are really 1,000 emanations in the world, 1,000 lights in the world. That's why Shlomo HaMelech had to marry 1,000 women. Each one is a facet of the world. Only the higher ones, there are a certain number that are not revealed in the world. There are only 620, to be accurate, that are revealed in the world. 613 mitzvahs and 7 mitzvahs de Rabbanan. Or according to another account, 613 mitzvahs and seven non-Jewish mitzvahs, 7 mitzvahs b'nei noach, which are not the same as ours. So therefore, there are really 620, what is called Tarach Amudei Or, the 620 pillars of light that build the world. And I'm sure you're well aware that 620 is the Gematria Keser. I'm sure you know that, right? 620 is Keser, which is the crown, the root, that's the crown, Hashem's crown, which is making him the king in the world. That is 620, Tarach. That is the real number of the mitzvahs that have been revealed in the world. I'm sure you're well aware that the Ten Commandments contain 620 letters, right? Didn't you? You must have. Didn't you know that? No? Not know that? The Ten Commandments, if you read, count them up, you'll see there's 620 letters in the Ten Commandments, because that is the Keter, that is the Keser, the crown, as it were, from which devolves the rest of Torah, right? Unfolds from there. And therefore you see that in the very ten that are the root of the Torah, all 613 are contained, or 620 are contained. That is why you only have 620 manifesting out of 1,000 lights that really comprise the world, because it is always a ten unfolding from a ten. That is the way it works. So in general, that is the reason why we have the Ten Commandments. Those are the root ones from which all the rest of the Torah unfold. Therefore, when Moshe Rabbeinu brought down the Luchos, it's not like he selected ten, you know, and gave us those as a sort of a sample, you know. The ten really contained the whole Torah in the deepest form. That's, of course, why they're engraved and not written. I'm sure you realize that the rest of the Torah is written, but the Luchos are engraved. Writing is always a much more superficial medium of expression than engraving. Writing means you put one color on top of another one, you put black on white, and the contrast between the two media is revealing the message. Engraving is where you don't write one thing on another. Engraving is where the thing itself is the message, right? The phrase in English is the medium is the message. Right? That's the you don't have a medium put on top of another background. The engraving, you actually have the material itself tells the message. And of course the Luchos, as you're well aware, were not simply engraved, they were bored through. You can't engrave more thoroughly than that, right? They weren't scratched out on the surface. The Luchos were bored through. So the letters went all the way through. And miraculously, if you read it from the back, it also read forwards. Right? They didn't read backwards. Yeah.
So why stone? Why not gold?
Why what?
Why do they do it on stone? Why engrave on stone?
What would you like to be engraved on?
Gold?
No. So stone is always the basic building block of reality. Evan, you have to understand this. Gold? Why gold? Gold is Midas HaDin, you know that. Gold is Din. Not allowed to wear gold in the Kodesh Kodashim. Gold is problematic. Gold is Din. Silver is Chesed. You should have said silver. That's what you meant probably, right? Silver is Chesed. But stone is all of that. Stone is the Malchus dimension. It's like the earth. It contains all. It's the ground of all creation. Hashem didn't create the world from a piece of gold. He created from the Even Shasir. He created the world from the rock on which the world is from, yeah, where they got their place in Harabais. Yes, what's that built over? Built over a rock. What's so special about the rock? That's the rock from which the world was formed. Even Shasir, the rock of foundation. From there the world spread out, right? Even is always, right? Even Ma'asu Aboinim, Ha'isal Rosh Bina. David, King David calls himself the stone that the builders rejected. Even is Midas HaMalchus. That is the rock, right, on which the world was founded. And of course, the Beis HaMikdash is built on the similar medium. So the Beis HaMikdash is also built on the rock. And David, who represents that, he's the seventh of the Midas in the world. He's not Chesed or Din or Tiferes. David is the totality, the background to all of them, the root of all of them, on which they all stand, as it were. He calls himself Even. Yeah, Ma'asu Aboinim, the rock. It's always like that. Even is always a feminine word. It's a female word. The world is always female. Hashem's creative source is male. The world is always feminine. All the words for the earth, vessels, kelim, eretz, adoma, those are all feminine. And Even is also female. Right? In fact, the Medaktikim say that Even is a conflation of Av and Ben. Even is Av and Ben, father and son, meshed into each other in the woman. That's where the transition takes place. That's a female word. So, yeah. You might have asked, why wasn't it Even Sapiri? That would be a valid question. Even Sapiri, like the Mate. Moshe Rabbeinu carried in his hand a staff made out of a stone that was sapphire stone, which means a transparent type of stone. That's an interesting question. That's maybe another time we can discuss. By the way, it was also engraved. He carried a Mate in his hand, on which Hashem's name was engraved, and also the plagues, the Tzach, etc. The names of the plagues were engraved on the Mate. And that was a different type of a stone, right? A type of stone that is sapir. Sapir is what in English you call sapphire. But what it really means is, it means clear, transparent, sapir. That's the same word as sphira in Hebrew, the spheres, right? Probably the English word spirit. Spirit comes from there. Sapphire and spirit. Anyway, that's another question. So it was engraved on stone, the luchos, because that's exactly, that means that in the reality of the world, asereis hadibros, yeah? You understand? The luchos are stone, they're what the world is made of. And engraved into those, right, is Aseres HaDibros. In other words, they're carved into the pattern of reality. That is what's real about the world. That's why the Maharal says that Matan Torah was forced on us. Why was the mountain held over us and the Jewish people forced? Why did they have to be forced? They said, Na'aseh v'nishma, they wanted it. Why did they have to be forced? Hashem said, you want my Torah? They said, yeah, we'll take it. So why do you have to force them? So there's a famous argument in Tosfos and the Maharal on this. But the Maharal's classic explanation is, Hashem forced us to accept the Torah because Torah is a reality. It's not a... You can't accept... If you want it, you'll have it. The next day, you'll decide you want. Torah is not an option. Torah is reality. You can't say, well, you'll accept reality, you won't accept reality. You know, today you'll say the world exists, tomorrow you say it won't. It's not up for grabs. Your behavior is up to your choice, but not to accept reality. And if the Torah was given as an option, it would be something that is either in reality or not in reality. The Torah had to be given in a way that showed that there's no option. So if there's no Torah, there's no world. That's the deep meaning. Im loy brisi yoma valayla. If it would not be for my Torah day and night, chukah shamayim v'aretz lo yisamti. I would never have made the laws. By the way, chukah also means to engrave. Chukah shamayim v'aretz. I would never... The carved out fashion nature of the world would not be. Right? Nefesh HaChaim says that if everyone would stop learning Torah for 1 second, the world would disappear. If you could arrange to have everybody stop learning Torah all around the world for 1 instant, the world would disappear at that moment. Or go back to Tohu Vavohu. Because Torah is supporting the reality of the world. It is the world at one level higher in the chain of causality. And therefore, says the Maharal, the Torah had to be given by force to indicate that it is a reality in the world. It's machriach itself on you because it's reality. You can deny Torah in the sense that you can deny the reality of the world, right? That's why it had to be given that way. And the fact that it's carved into the stone means that this is expressed in the reality of the world. That's why did Hashem have to carve the luchos? Why didn't he write it in the sky? You know, why didn't he could have done anything? He could have had it in neon, luminous sky writing. He could have. What's wrong with the parchment, for that matter? Right? This is good enough for Sefer Torah. No, the luchos are engraved. That means that the background and the foreground Right? It is all. That is the root of Torah. That now the details come out. The details come out at other layers. And they have to be expressed and grasped at other levels and other layers. But that is what the lucha is. Now you understand the breaking of the lucha is what it means. Now you understand, not just a simple matter. When Moshe, when it broke the luchas, right? But that's not, here was a rejection of reality when the Jewish people didn't accept the Torah at that moment, or when there was a sin that took place at that moment that breaks down the fabric of reality itself, right? That's not a trivial matter. And then it had to be done the hard way, carved out by Moshe Rabbeinu himself. And this is very important. That's why it says, Kasveim al luach libecha. You should write them upon the tablets of your heart, right? Luach libecha. That's what it means. You have to write them on the tablets of your heart. And you have to, your heart has to become the luchos. Right? Kasvei means it's engraving, writing, all part of the same category. But it has to be written on the luchos of your heart. That's, by the way, why the luchos are depicted with round tops. Why in every shul throughout history that you go to, you see the luchos are depicted as two oblong tablets with rounded tops. The luchos didn't have rounded tops. They were square. They were cubic shapes. They didn't have rounded tops. Why do the Jewish people choose to depict the luchos with two round tops? The answer is, it's a childlike depiction of the human heart. That's what it means. The two luchos are the two sides of the heart. And you see the beautiful indication of that is that, how does a child draw a heart? You draw a heart like that. So here you have the luchos, and you round the two tops to show that this is kasveim al luach libecha. We're not just putting them on stone that gets put up someplace in the shul. The indication is, your heart should look like that. Right? The reality of the Ten Commandments containing the whole Torah, that should be engraved on your heart. The real luchos. Right? It's meaningless having them on a piece of stone. That stone has to be the stone, right? The stone heart that the human being has. Right? Then eventually it will be asiresi mikem eslev ha'evin. Eventually Hashem will take away the stone heart and replace it with a heart of flesh. But it has to be one on which the writing is already being engraved. That's the luchos. By the way, that's also one of the tragedies of the Hebrew, modern Hebrew language. The modern Hebrew language. You know that modern Hebrew is very often crafted in such a way that it expresses the opposite of the truth. You know that? Modern Hebrew, right? Very often. That's why the Jewish people never spoke Hebrew as a spoken language. Since the Bais Rishon, when prophecy left the world and they could no longer live at a prophetic level, they never spoke Hebrew. Even if they had to construct another language like Ladino or Yiddish, they made up a language rather than speak Hebrew. Because when you speak Hebrew in the mundane world, you prostitute it, you pervert it into the mundane or the opposite of what it should be. And therefore, you know, it's a tragedy that speak modern Hebrew, then you are very dangerous, very hard to hear the spiritual meanings, the correct meanings of words. Right? And that is one of the examples is luach. A luach in Hebrew is something that has to be, it's a background on which you carve something so it can never be erased. In modern Hebrew, a luach is a blackboard. Right? They chose the word luach for a blackboard. Something that you can easily wipe off. The teacher writes on it and you can easily wipe it off. Right? It's exactly the opposite. The idea of a blackboard is something that you can write again and again. And there's no other word for it in Hebrew. Even in the most orthodox Yiddish cheder, when the Rebbe tells the child to write on the board, he says, Geitzum Luach. That's what he says. You can't say it any other way. He calls it Luach. It's very tragedy. It's the exact opposite. Child's mind, he associates a Luach as a blackboard that you can quickly rub off and there's no sign left. It's exactly the opposite. The Luach is supposed to be something on which the material is carved so that it becomes part of the medium. Exactly the opposite. Anyway, that's another.
Why does they cost a Luach that should be engraved?
I once asked Rosh Shapira that question, and he said that that's the category is called ksiva. The category is called ksiva. It has various forms, and chakika is one of those forms. So it's the general reference is kasvim. Yeah, make sure they're there. If you want to know how you make them, the method should be engraving. Yeah. Aluach libecha echdeveim. Aluach libam echdeveim. It says also it's a general category. Anyway, the point is, when you do it on your heart, make sure it's engraved. So that is some introduction to why Aseres Adibros, we're a long way off from honoring parents, but that is some background about the luchos, what was special about them, why there had to be luchos, and why there needed to be 10 of them, because those are the root categories out of which the whole Torah unfolds. Now the next question is, why Are there two sets, 5 and 5? And why is honoring parents on the first half? So let's take a look at that. There are 5 because there are 2 categories of interaction in the world. There's your interaction with Hashem, and then there's your interaction with other people, which is a separate category. It's not every time you do a mitzvah between you and another person, of course you're also fulfilling. This is also for you. Not only are the negative commandments coming out of the first, but the second category of mitzvahs, the interpersonal mitzvahs, are also coming out of the first. Just like you pointed out, every time you do observe a negative commandment, you're also observing the original. Similarly, whenever you interact with another person correctly, you're also interacting with Hashem correctly. Obviously, that's the second category. When I relate to you properly and I deal with you in the way the Torah requires, I'm doing that because you are a human being, but I'm doing it at a deeper level because Hashem has commanded me. So in relating to Hashem, you relate to Him. In relating to another human being, you relate to the person as an entity and to Hashem who commands this. Yeah? Actually, it's deeper than that if you examine it more carefully. And that's because when you relate to another person correctly, the pnimius, the depth of relating to that person, is because he is a Tzelem Elokim. In other words, there's a spark. When you relate to a human being properly, right? The real obligation to relate to a person is because he's human. And being human means he has a spark of Elokus inside him. Why is killing a person wrong? Why is killing a person wrong? Killing animals also wrong. The Torah says, "Dam shafach," when you kill an animal. Not allowed. Not allowed to kill an animal for no reason. Not good at all. But the difference between killing a human and an animal is that there's a much stronger gilui of Hashem in a human being. When a person's killed, when a person dies, the real tragedy, the deep tragedy, is not that some biological material is no longer functioning. The deep tragedy is that a vessel for Hashem's Kedusha in the world is no longer being used for that. Why do you say Kaddish when someone dies? Kaddish has got nothing to do with the dead. Kaddish doesn't mention death or the dead or anything. It doesn't even mention the person who died. Kaddish is replacing the Kaddish, the Kedusha in the world. When some Kedusha leaves the world, a person dies. So less manifestation of Hashem in the world. Kaddish is an attempt to replace and get everybody to join in and agree and emphasize and express Kedusha in the world, right? For the person who has left that community poorer because there's no, that spark of Kedusha no longer in the world. Kaddish is a replacement. Killing somebody is the real offense of killing is an offense against Hashem. The immediate offense is taking a person out of the world and depriving him of his opportunity to live in the world. But the real offense is that you extinguished a spark of Hashem's Kedusha in the world. That's the problem. And therefore, when you treat a human being correctly, the mitzvah is, what's real, the depth of it is that you are really honoring and bringing to expression in the world more Hashem's gilui in the world, right? That's really the depth. Of course, you mustn't get carried away with that. You start looking at human beings as, and you forget to see them. Yeah, you see only Hashem when you deal with a human being. That's very dangerous. Then the human being becomes an object of worship of Hashem. If you go, that's terrible, right? You must not see a human being as only a manifestation of Hashem. You can't forget that he is in himself. If you think that a human being is only a way of honoring Hashem, and then you'll come to do ridiculous things. A person's sick, you'll go visit him because Hashem commanded you, right? So really, this mitzvah is between me and Hashem. The person's not relevant, right? Because you only want to think about Hashem when you go visit the sick person. So what will come out of that? The sicker he is, the better. If he's sicker, if he's really suffering, that's even better. He's a more mahudr. He's a better lulav to shake. He's a beautiful esrog when he's really in pain. Right? And if you go there and you find he's got better, you say, darn, the chutzpah to get better. I came to visit him. That's a tragedy, right? Of course. Person, you have to relate to a human being as the person that he is, but beneath the surface, he is the person that he is only because he is, and that's why a person who's incorporated more Torah into himself is more chashuv. A person who's more ben Torah, right? A person who's a big Talmud Chacham or a Godel b'Torah, he represents more of Hashem's Kedusha in the world, right? That's what it is. That's why there's a mitzvah to be dovek. There's a mitzvah to cleave to Talmud Chachamim. And it's expressed in the Torah as the mitzvah of cleaving to Hashem. It's not metaphorical or poetic. Because where the Torah is in the world is in the hearts and the minds of Talmud Chachamim. And that where the Torah is in the world Hashem is. And therefore, and of course to become more godly in yourself, you have to incorporate more Torah in yourself. Right? The more Torah you know, genuinely know, the more Torah is seeped into the fiber of your understanding and your behavior, to that extent you have become more contained, more of the Kedusha of reality. And therefore, those are the two categories. Actually, while we're on the subject, we should just mention that when you relate to Hashem correctly, Right? Can you see that it should follow that if you relate to Hashem correctly, that should also be relating to people? When you go back to Anochi Hashem Elokecha, you fulfill it correctly. We said it contains everything. Okay, yeah, right, no? And therefore, if I relate to Hashem correctly, I do Shabbos correctly, or something Hashem wants me to do. Actually, even though no other human being is around, there really should be, in that should also be an emanation to other people. And the truth is there is. When you do a mitzvah on your own, you uplift the Kedusha of the world and it benefits everyone. If you break Shabbos in private where no one sees, you eat something you shouldn't eat, right? No one sees. So you think this is private. This has been Adam Lamakim. I'm only affecting my relationship with Hashem. Wrong. Wrong. When you do something in private and you bring down the level of Kedusha in your own neshama, you bring down the Kedusha in the world. You make less available for me. The Jewish people, the whole world at a bigger level, but the Jewish people is one corporate spiritual entity. When one of us brings down the level, we all suffer. When the Jewish people sinned at the golden calf, Hashem said to Moshe, Lech Rei, you go down, because your people sinned. You go down, he had nothing to do with it. No, it's a corporate body, he's the head. When the body goes down, the head has to go down too. And therefore, I have a claim on you when you do something perverted. When you do something private and perverted, I have a claim on you. You've offended me. Because you've put tumah into the world, that makes it less, I can less easily develop, right? When the Jewish people falls to a level that is below the level of prophecy, then those great people who would have been prophets can no longer be. I can no longer be masig, my tachlis in the world, because you've brought the level down. So I have a claim against you. Every avera against Hashem is also an avera against the corporate body of the Jewish people, because when you push Hashem away from you, he steps back from us. Is this clear? And therefore, in Bein Adam LaMakim, you're also offending other people. In Bein Adam LaChavera, you're also offending Hashem. You can't extract the one from the other. I think Rabbi Chanan Wasserman points out both those two. Yeah, any other questions? Now, let's go to the next piece. Why is honoring parents the fifth of the first five? After all, when I relate to my parents, so I'm relating to, when I relate to my wife correctly, or my children, I've mitzvahs to each of those parties. Why, when I relate to my parents, why is that somehow worthy of being put on the first of the luchos? So let's just spend a few minutes on that idea. To ask the question accurately, you have to say, why is honoring parents correctly on the first side, and why is it the fifth of the first five? What does that mean? And the answer is that the essence of honoring parents, that means the depth here to perceive, is that when you turn towards your parents and deal with them correctly, you are turning toward your point of origin. That's the focus. What's unique about your parents, unlike all other relationships, is that they represent Hashem in your life, in the sense that they are the proximate cause of your existence. When you turn back to your parents, you've begun the journey back to Hashem. A sensitive and intelligent person, when he realizes, I'm not the cause of my own existence, he looks back to his parents. I needed them. I wouldn't be here without them. But they come from someplace. They needed their parents. And they come from someplace. And eventually he'll get back to Adam and Chava. And when he gets back there, he knows that they didn't cause their own existence. They came from someplace else. They must have come from Hashem. They did come from there. And therefore a person who relates to his parents correctly and is a seeker for the truth and a perceptive person will discover Hashem. And therefore when you turn back from the mitzvahs between us and each other, and you turn back to your point of origin, you look back, yeah, you're on the second side of the luchos, and you're not coveting, and you're not stealing, and you're doing all those things. Then you take one step back, you turn around, and you look back to where you came from. You discover the fifth of the commandments between you and Hashem, because your parents are the interface between Hashem and you. So the first five commandments are relating to Hashem, the second five are relating to human beings, the interface between people. And Hashem is your parents. The unique aspect of your parents is that on the one hand, they're human beings, right? And therefore, they're the ones that connect to the second half of the luchos. But on the other hand, they are standing, as it were, in Hashem's position. When you look back to them, you're looking back at the first part of a vision that takes you all the way back to your original point of origin. Your parents manifest Hashem's creation in the world. And that's, of course, why bringing a child into the world is such a godly thing. There's nothing higher you can do than that. There's nothing higher than you can do that creating a human being. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. It's crazy. Human being who full of his own finite, limited bodily existence in his body that's given to decomposition, that smells bad, that has excrement. Yeah. Such a person can do an action that brings life, a human being, into the world. That's unbelievable. He becomes a channel through which Hashem manifests life in the world. And therefore, your parents are that channel, so they're absolutely unique. Relating to your parents is like relating to Hashem. And therefore, some of the laws of honoring parents, uniquely, whenever you relate to a human being, you're relating to the Kedusha and the manifestation of Hashem. But when you relate to your parents, you're relating to that spark of Kedusha that is immediately connected in your line of origin, and therefore you're doing no less, as it were, than looking back to and honoring Hashem correctly. And that's why many poskim hold, like the Rambam, that even if your parents are bad people, you owe them exactly the same. This is an argument in Halacha. But the Rambam and others hold that if your parents are extremely bad, bad news, abandoned you, brutalized you, had nothing to do with you, or gave you away for adoption, you never met them, you stand up when your father walks into the room, you don't use his first name, you're not allowed to say he's wrong. Why? Not because you respect him as a person. You shouldn't. You shouldn't respect him as a person. On the contrary, you should not respect his values, and you have to correct him. But you owe him the obligation of these mitzvahs because he's your point of origin.
So ultimately, the outcome of the fifth commandment is anochi.
So the origin of all of them is anochi.
Correct.
If you mean outcome in your process of development, yes. When you go back to your parents, right? See, let me say to you like this. You know that all mitzvahs and all Torah themes can be translated into many dimensions. You can talk about them on a Kabbalistic level, on a straightforward halachic domain. You can also talk about all of them in a Musa domain. Torah ideas translate into Musa as well. What's the Musa of relating to parents? What's the Musa? That means, what's the character trait that's essential in relating to parents? The answer is Hakaras HaTov, gratitude. Gratitude means looking beyond yourself to where a point of origin, you know, you see it very beautifully in English. Gratitude is one word, and admission is another word. In Hebrew, thanking is the same word. Thanking and admission are the same word. In Hebrew, modeh means I thank you or I admit. Now, what's admission got to do with thanking? The answer is, when I thank you, I admit that it wasn't me. I couldn't do this on my own. I didn't extend to that point. I'm powerless in that domain. I wouldn't have had this thing had it not been for you. So I trace the thing back to its genuine point of origin and admit that it wasn't me. The opposite of this is, a person refuses to trace anything back to a point of origin. That person is manifesting idolatry. A person refuses to take anything back to a point of origin. I am the point of all origin. What did Paro say? Ani li yoiri va'ani asisini. Pharaoh said, I made me. Was the man's raving? What do you mean, I made me? And believe, what is it? I made me. What he meant was, I'm self-contained. I don't owe my existence to anything outside of me. I am the totality of my own existence and explanation. Right? That's the ultimate idolatry. Rav Huttner writes that there were many Gedolei Torah who would take a student and spend time with him and teach him, even if he was unrefined. Even if the student had characteristics that needed work and were problematic. But a student who couldn't show gratitude, they would reject. A Talmid who came, who couldn't be makir toiv, who couldn't acknowledge and say thank you, that person they wouldn't teach. Why? Why is that midah worse? There are a lot of very bad middahs in the human personality. Because a person who can't go beyond himself and acknowledge a point of origin outside of himself is hopeless, that person. He'll never discover, he'll never find Hashem. He sees the whole world as parts of his own existence. And therefore, a person, the Musa Avoida, right, which is the central Avoida, it's negating ego. I'm not the be-all and end-all and an explanation of myself. So when you negate ego, what do? You acknowledge that you came from someplace. The first step in that exercise is acknowledging you have parents. The first step in a trivial way is you give me some food, I say thank you, I admit that I didn't have it without you. But in the first major step is when you become aware as a child that you're not here of your own accord, you look back to your parents, you see, oh, there's a point of origin. Now you realize not only this favor or that favor, your entire existence in the world is dependent on other human beings. You look back to them. Now you take that process back and back and back. Which means a person who has the mitzvah of Hakaras HaTov will discover Hashem. A person who fulfills the mitzvah of honoring his parents will discover Hashem. And that's why it's in the Ten Commandments. It's in the Ten Commandments because it is no less than the aspect of teaching you to reverse the process of interacting with yourself and other human beings and take a step back, one step back, where do you come from? That will take you back to the first half of the Luchos. And from there it will take you back to the first of the Aseres HaDibros, which is Anocha Hashem Elokecha. That's what's unique about honoring parents, and that's why it's such a big deal. It isn't just the decency, and you know they spend time on you, and they took out loans so you could go to cheder. You know, that's not the end point. Is the concept, and therefore that you'll find in the whole Shulchan Aruch here does not mention anything to do with parents' values and their spiritual level. It's got nothing to do with that. It's the fact that they put you in the world. On the contrary, you might have a very difficult emotional relationship with them. You might owe them nothing emotionally, right? On the contrary, they might have harmed you. That's got nothing to do with it. They're the point of origin. They brought you into the world. Therefore, you owe them. The late poskim say, achreinim say, you should try to find something admirable about your parents, even if they're bad people. Try to find something they're good at, some special quality, and look up to that and respect it. It's important. The halachas of honoring parents are not to respect their values. The halachas are to stand up when they walk in the room, not use their first name, not belittle them, not embarrass them if they embarrass you. Right? We'll see all the laws. You have to feed them and clothe them. These are all the mitzvahs to parents, in as much as the fact that they are your parents. Being admirable people spiritually, they have to earn that. That's a different question, right? Is this clear? And that is why honoring parents is in the Ten Commandments, because it's one of the root concepts in the world. And really, you know, it's interesting, whenever the Gemara or the Torah gives examples of people who are outstanding in Kibbud Avayim, it gives non-Jewish examples. Why do we need to look to non-Jews for this? We haven't got Jews who excelled in this. Since when do we look to non-Jewish examples? One of the ideas is that this is a natural thing. Any human being, you don't need to be Jewish to understand that you're not the cause of your own existence. Any human being should realize that. Yeah, the classic example in Torah is Esav. Esau, right? Esau was not a spiritually, you know, admirable person. He was very problematic. But he was unbelievable. He wore special clothes to go see his father. When he took his father food, he wore special clothes. Imagine your father says, could you please bring me up a cup of tea? You go put on your Shabbos clothes. You put on your Shabbos suit to go take him his tea. That's what he used to do, right? And the other classic example in the Gemara is Dama ben Asina. He was a non-Jew living in Ashkelon. And the Gemara says that he wouldn't wake his father even when a fortune was at stake. Right? You know, his father sold jewels. And when the Chachamim came to his house to buy one of the jewels they needed for the Cheshen of the Kohen Gadol, his father was sleeping and the key was under his pillow. And Dama ben Asina dealt with the Chachamim and he wouldn't sell them. He refused the sale. A very profitable sale. He refused it because he wouldn't wake his father, because his father was sleeping with a key under his pillow. The sages didn't know that was the reason, so they offered him double. And he still refused. Right? He didn't wake his father. And he refused to make a profit because he wouldn't wake his father. Finally, when his father woke up, he ran after them and sold them the jewel for the original price. He didn't want to make a profit on having honored his father. That's an unbelievable level. It's nothing completely legitimate to do that. But he wouldn't do it. And that is a non-Jew. Why? Why are we learning it from here? One of the themes here is that a sensitive human being, a developed human being, should realize that he's not the cause of his own existence. And just as he realizes that his parents were necessary in his generation, and by exactly the same token, he realizes that they weren't the cause of their existence, and immediately he discovers Hashem. So that is, I mean, even the most hardened evolutionist has to think along these lines. Even this evolutionist who's convinced that his original parents were a pair of orangutans somewhere, even he has to take that back to something, right? Even if he takes it back to the most primitive biological material, he has to be aware that there isn't even a theory yet in science about how that came about, right? Even if he believes in the whole story of evolution, he still has to believe that the process began someplace that's beyond his. At least that should take him back to ponder these things. And of course, if you know anything about Jewish history and you know that each generation back we came from was greater spiritually, then it makes the process easy. So that is the reason behind these mitzvahs, and why Kibbud Av V'Em is, I think it also explains. Yeah, also understand why you have equal honor to your father and your mother. Right? Father and mother. In the mystical sources, it says everything in the world has a father and a mother. You need both domains. You need both aspects, chomer and tzura, the spiritual and the physical. Both of those elements combine to form who you are. Let's just spend a minute and begin, unless you have any questions on this theme. Let's at least look at one halacha here, right? It says like this, Ezu kibud ezu meira, which is called covered, which is called meira, v'dinehim. These are the laws of honoring parents. It's like this. First is tzarich lizar ma'id b'choed aviv v'imo b'meira om. You have to be very careful in honoring your father and your mother and their reverence. In other words, two aspects to the mitzvah, kovod and yiro. We'll see the difference between them. This is very perplexing, by the way. Why does the Shulchan Aruch say, as Aleph, tzarich lizar ma'id, you have to be very careful in honoring your father and mother? That's very unusual. You don't find in other mitzvahs that the Shulchan Aruch tells you have to be careful. He doesn't introduce taking a lulav by saying you have to be very careful when you take a lulav, when you sit in a sukkah. Or, yeah, I don't know if there's any other place in Shulchan Aruch, any other law, where it says that you have to be exceptionally careful when you do it. Talmud Torah, it just says you've got to learn Torah, right? It doesn't say you have to be exceptionally careful, right? Person teaches Torah, it tells about how you teach. It doesn't start by saying you have to be extremely careful. Honoring your Rebbe, Hilchas Kibud Talmid Chacham, how you honor a Talmid Chacham, it doesn't start by saying you have to be exceptionally careful. So why does the Shulchan Aruch begin the laws of honoring parents? This is halachia. This is not a spiritual exhortation or encouragement. Why does he have to say that one has to be extremely careful in honoring and respecting parents? What would you say?
It's very difficult.
Some say that's the reason. You have to be very careful because it's classically the most difficult mitzvah. Some say that. Others say that the reason is because there's a halacha contained in this. What you said gives you an appreciation, a depth, but not a halacha. Not Shulchan Aruch is halacha. So in this statement, you have to be careful when honoring parents. We need to find a halachic theme. So some poskim say, some later poskim say, this means that this takes priority. That means all else being equal, if you had this mitzvah and another one, this one would take precedence, right? Because the tzarich lizar ma'id doesn't say that by other mitzvahs. And therefore, if you had two mitzvahs in front of you, right? One of them honoring your parent, and one of them another mitzvah, all else being equal, you would honor your parent and let the other mitzvah. This does not apply if you've started another mitzvah, right? The rule is, ha'esek b'mitzvah, potam an ha'mitzvah. If you're already doing a mitzvah, then you don't stop it, not even to honor a parent. Right? The general rule there is you don't stop one mitzvah for another one unless the second one is a mitzvah yveres. That means it is a mitzvah that is passing. And secondly, that only you can do it. That's the rule. If you're doing a mitzvah that can be put off and delayed and come back to, let's say like learning. Let's say you're learning Torah, right? And your father wants a cup of tea. So now, if he wants tea now, not tomorrow, right? He doesn't want tea tomorrow, he wants a cup of tea now, and he wants you to make him the tea, then you close the book and you go make your father tea. Because it's a mitzvah yveres, right? He wants tea now, and you must make it. Then you close your gemara, you go make him tea. If, however, he wants something done that doesn't have to be done now, like your father says, could you please post this letter for me? And the next postal collection's at 5 o'clock, right? And it's now 11 o'clock in the morning. So you don't have to do it now, your dad doesn't mind. You can do it when you finish learning. You could do that. Or, alternatively, if he wants a cup of tea and your little sister's around and she's happy to make it for him and your dad is the man who makes the tea, then ask your little sister to make it. Why should you stop learning? But if you are asked to do a mitzvah that needs to be done now and that you personally have to do, then you would go and do that mitzvah. But other than that, if you're oisik in a mitzvah, you don't stop it in order to do another one. So that... some thoughts about why there's a special sif here that says you have to be careful with this mitzvah. Let's just read one more and we'll stop there. The Ramah says, Umikol mokim ein beistin kofin al mitzvahs kibud avayim. Very interesting. Beistin do not give lashes or force a person to honor his parents. Dahavale mitzvahs esay shematn schara betzida. She ein beistin kofin al. Because there is a principle in Torah that when the Torah gives a reward for a mitzvah, beistin don't force it. That's the concept. So if, for example, a person has a halachic obligation, right, and he refuses to fulfill his obligation, based in a place where based in has jurisdiction, today, unfortunately, we don't have that, really, by and large. But in a place where Beis Din has jurisdiction, they have executive powers and police powers, they would force a person to fulfill his mitzvahs. They can even take away his property, right? Beis Din can appropriate your property in order to force you to live up to your obligations. But there's a principle that that Beis Din do not force a person to do a mitzvah where the Torah gives a reward. So if the Torah says, send away the mother bird, that you shall live long. Or the Torah says, Kabel es avicha ves emecha, leman yarichun yamecha. Since the Torah says, right with the mitzvah, honor your parents, that you shall have a long life. Whatever that means, that long life. Since the Torah has stipulated a reward, the lomdus is that, without going into the lomdus, there is a principle that takes away from Beis Din the obligation to force a person. Here the Mefoshim bring an example of somebody who wouldn't honor his father, so one of the Moirim had him tied to a post, about to be lashed, and another Moira walked past and he said, you can't do that, you don't... And he said, no, I'm only frightening him, I'm only trying to scare him, I'm trying to threaten him. In other words, we certainly try to make every effort to make sure that people honor their parents. But Beis Din do not force a person to fulfill the mitzvah. Be very careful here, this is al mitzvahs kibud avayim. We're not talking about Yirah. Yirah is things that are disrespectful. So if a person is being disrespectful to his parents, he's insulting them, or he's being downright offensive to his parents, Beis Din most certainly will force him. No question about that. This is only kibud, which means feeding them, clothing them, putting their shoes on, covering them when they're cold, taking them where they need to be taken. That's kibud, right? And that's where the Torah says, Laman Yerichun. Kaber es avecha v'semecha laman. So since the mitzvah is phrased as kovod, kibud avayim, and there it says, you must honor your parents and you have reward. On that positive mitzvah we don't enforce, Beis Din doesn't enforce. If a person doesn't want to go give his father food, then Beis Din will not give him lashes. But if the person's doing the negative, which is a totally different mitzvah in the Torah, ish imoi v'aviv tirou, a person should respect his mother and father. That has got nothing to do with matan tzchara b'tzida. That certainly could be forced by Beis Din. Okay, we'll stop here. We're just beginning the laws. Maybe we'll have an opportunity further.